Right. Well, as I'm sure you all know, Jennifer is a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. She's a past president of the Canadian Philosophical Association and of the Central Division of the American Philosophical Association. She's had various visiting positions, including an invited professorship at the École Normale Supérieure. And she has Oxford connections. She's been a visiting fellow at Old Souls, and actually her PhD supervisor was John McDowell at Pittsburgh, who of course was also a past Locke lecturer. The general title, as again I'm sure you know for these lectures, is Recognizing Knowledge, Intuitive and Reflective Epistemology. And I thought I'd just make a few general remarks for purposes of orientation. So there's a boring old stereotype of philosophy as a subject that makes no progress, whereas I think any reasonable person would agree that there is progress in psychology and cognitive science and allied disciplines. And those are disciplines which are inextricably linked to philosophy in various ways. I mean, the more one learns about psychology, the more one realizes how much philosophy depends on psychological assumptions about human beings, and often very dodgy assumptions. And so as long as philosophers are open to developments in psychology, it seems that you'd expect that progress in psychology would lead to progress in philosophy. I mean, of course, the kind of progress that we're talking about is likely to be messy on both sides, and not the kind that can be summarized in one-liners. But it's progress nonetheless. And of course, the trade is not all one way. I mean, philosophers help make theoretical sense of developments in psychology, and even in subjects like animal ethology. So in my experience, the more one finds out about this sort of area, the more pointless it seems to divide what's happening strictly into the philosophical and the psychological. I mean, a lot of it just seems to be both at once, and none the worse for that. And I think that's most obvious in philosophy of mind, but it also applies in epistemology. I mean, epistemologists, they're mostly discussing human knowledge and belief, and often making claims about it that just don't withstand psychological scrutiny. And I think we'd also benefit from epistemologists thinking a bit more about what non-human animals know about their environment and about each other. And methodologically, if we ignore the psychological basis of our practices of knowledge ascription, I mean, we run a serious risk of not being alerted to possible sources of bias and error in the judgments that we make about, for example, hypothetical cases in epistemology. So Jennifer Nagel is a leader in this field. I mean, she has an extremely rare combination of expertise in both philosophy and psychology at the highest level, with both a massive knowledge of the details of research findings and a very powerful sense of how they fit together into a big picture. I mean, you know, as you can see by reading it, her work is razor sharp, both philosophically and psychologically. And as far as I can tell in this area, she just is simply the best in the world. Yes, sure. Well, that's part, yes, that's part of the point. Her early seminal work on these topics was on psychological biases in the data that had been used to argue for contextualism and related ideas in epistemology. And she also wrote the most telling critique of the negative program in experimental philosophy. The program that was criticizing philosophy for what was called reliance on philosophical intuitions. And I think her response to that critique, it was all the more effective because she's perfectly sympathetic in principle to the use of experimental results to cast light on philosophical questions, provided the experiments are properly designed and executed and interpreted by the appropriate standards of experimental psychology. So more recently, she's been developing a positive account of knowledge ascription in humans and other animals that I think is likely to mould a lot of the best work in epistemology for decades to come, particularly when she publishes the book that we're all waiting for. So if I had a little bit more pressure. She's also got a very wide philosophical range. And she's got expertise on early modern philosophy. I mean, so very appropriately for a Locke lecture, she's published on John Locke's epistemology. And actually through Jennifer that I learnt about classical Indo-Tibetan epistemology. For example, that they had more natural and elegant Gettier cases more than 1,000 years before Gettier. And I think she's also helped to make Toronto, I mean, perhaps the most important centre in the world for the analytic approach to classical Indian philosophy. I mean, she's rather stolen a march from us there because, of course, Oxford was where a lot of that first developed through Bimal Matalal. I think I've also got a more personal debt, and I think I've learnt more from her directly than from any other epistemologist. I mean, I did try quite hard to think of a counterexample, but I couldn't. And that's both from her papers and her comments on drafts of mine, which I shamelessly exploit her for. And I mean, she, you know, when I send her a draft, she usually returns very detailed and compelling comments within 48 hours, attaching PDFs of a few papers in psychology that I ought to have read, but of course hadn't. And she's actually also very generously offered to have individual meetings with people who want to email her and discuss some of the issues that are coming up in the lectures. So I hope that isn't going to be too onerous a task. But and so anyway, I should shut up. This lecture is going to be on the strange divergence between intuitive and reflective knowledge. So let's welcome Professor May.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much. That man is a hard act to follow in more than one way. But I'll do my best. Knowledge does not have to be difficult. Many things are easily known. The face or voice of a close friend. The fact that I'm standing here right now speaking to you. The best move to take in a game of tic-tac-toe or noughts and crosses, as you call it here, against an adversary who has just made a foolish blunder. Yeah, not to brag, but if you slip up when we're playing that game, I will take you down, because I know how. I'm not saying knowledge is always easy. There are many things that are knowable only with great difficulty, if indeed they are knowable at all. For me personally, hard targets include quantum mechanics, anything to do with sports, with the possible exception of figure skating, and the best move to take in a game of chess against an adversary who has only a subtle vulnerability. You slip up when we're playing chess, you will probably still beat me, because mostly I don't know what I'm doing when I'm playing that game. If each of us imagines a spectrum organized from the things that are easy to know over to the things that are difficult, I wager we'll find some strong individual differences between us in terms of what is placed where. But there's one target whose place on the easy-hard scale is somewhat peculiar. I think not just for me, but for all of us. As you may be guessing, or indeed, as you may already know, by the way, there's handouts if anyone wants one. The target I have in mind is knowledge itself. How hard is it to know about knowledge? When someone asks you whether knowledge is easily known, there are a couple different things she might have in mind. She might be asking about individual instances of knowing, whether those are easily spotted and identified as such, like members of some visually distinctive species of animal, you know, giraffes, as opposed to some kind of sparrow that's got a lot of close cousins. Or she might be asking about the abstract general nature of knowledge itself, whether that's something that's easily known, like the nature of something simple, you know, the circle, the square, as opposed to the nature of something convoluted and mysterious, like the football offside rule or loop quantum gravity. On either way of understanding the question, I think, there's a strong case to be made, and I'm shortly going to make it, that knowing is a soft target, with abundant, easily spotted instances and a very simple, easily known nature, general nature. You can state it in 8 words and you're done. Or not. Unfortunately, or actually like fortunately for me, because I have to give a series of 6 lectures, there's also a strong instinctive case to be made that knowledge is an extremely hard target, indeed so hard, somewhat baffling how we ever could have said it was easy. I'm going to try to make that case as well shortly. And once we start thinking of knowledge in this second way, the damage, I'm going to argue, will spread rapidly. First, it's going to threaten our abstract general characterization of the nature of knowledge. And then, before long, it's going to give us the feeling that virtually nothing can ever be known by the likes of us. That's not a good feeling. And it's also just really strange. What is it about knowledge that it affords these 2 different approach paths that lead to wildly conflicting results? Is one of these ways of thinking some kind of mistake? And if so, why do we still naturally have it? Is it possible, perhaps, that the antagonism between these ways of thinking could, in some circumstances, be productive? I want to know. And now I've forgotten what I was going to say next. What was I going to say next, Richard? Oh, yes, my aim in this series of lectures is to explore both of these human ways of judging knowledge and to open an investigation into the divergence between them, a divergence that I believe is rooted in certain core features of our natural capacity to detect the presence and absence of knowledge in each other, a capacity that I think has been misunderstood both in philosophy and in psychology. My project for the series of 6 lectures is to develop a new way of thinking about knowledge, a way that will draw on our ordinary our ordinary ability to detect it in each other, but we'll do so in light of a deeper understanding of the nature of this ability. If the project succeeds, we should emerge with a deeper understanding of the nature of knowledge itself. If the project fails, I still want us to have a good time. So I'm going to try to take us to places that epistemologists don't usually go. I feel like I've just sort of, did I just implicate something bad about epistemologists? Wait, what was I going to say next? Oh, yes, in the course of these lectures, we will look at the proximal mechanisms that drive our pursuit of knowledge and enable us to detect it in each other. I'll be drawing on research from a wide range of disciplines, including comparative and developmental psychology, sociology, linguistics, and artificial intelligence. We'll be looking at curiosity in rats. We'll examine the Gettier case responses of non-human primates. We'll review epistemic change of state markers in conversation. And we'll see some new research in reinforcement learning in deep neural networks. But my point of departure, and indeed my point of inspiration for the series of lectures, is actually a very old discussion of the problem of knowing knowledge itself. If we go back almost 2,000 years to the start of the Nyaya tradition in Sanskrit epistemology, Nyaya meaning right reasoning or logic, broadly conceived, we find a clear statement of the problem, a simple but powerful theoretical framework for handling it, and a superb image that will guide our way forward. We'll start with the theoretical framework. And it's awkward to do this in Oxford because, of course, there are people here who know much more about Sanskrit philosophy than I do. And to those people, I say, bear with me, or better yet, correct me when I stumble. And to my fellow beginners in understanding this tradition, I want to say a few words about the text. The underlying basis of the Nyaya Sutra is a series of 528 philosophical points or sutras on topics ranging from epistemology and metaphysics to philosophy of language to ethics, philosophical logic as well, philosophical methodology. These texts are apparently crystallized from a long oral tradition and customarily credited to a figure known as Gautama, not the Buddha, this is the other Gautama, who is somewhat mysterious. Perhaps he was writing in the second century of the Common Era, perhaps several centuries earlier. He's often referred to just more cautiously as the author of the sutras. On top of that underlying basis, we have a layered series of commentaries from later generations of scholars, and the one I'll be quoting from most today is Vatsyayana's commentary on Nyaya, which dates to about the year 450 of the Common Era. Translations of the text are from Matthew Dasty's and Stephen Phillips Hackett volume and appear on your handout. So in the Nyaya tradition, knowledge is, as commentator Vatsyayana puts it, veridical cognition produced in the right way. And to keep things interesting, there's more than one right way. So the old tradition counts four, perception, inference, analogy, and testimony. And it's very much emphasized in this tradition that these are ways of knowing, not ways of thinking. So perception, as this tradition defines it, demands a connection between sense faculty and object. It's inerrant and it's definitive. So illusion and hallucination do not count as perception. They count as pseudo-perception. So after describing the visual mirage of water in the distance on a hot day, Vatsyayana says it is exactly in order, quote, to exclude such false cognition from the definition of perception proper that the sutra, quote, includes the qualifier inerrant in that definition. Perception, which is inerrant, cognizes something as it truly is, undeviating from what is true. So the choice to use the word perception in its success sense is, I think, not unheard of in contemporary philosophy. It's a little bit more eyebrow-raising that they reserve the term inference for what we would call sound inference from known premises. Fallacious or ill-grounded reasoning is not inference, but pseudo-inference. So when things go wrong in attempts at reasoning, Batsyayana says, quote, it is not the case that there is an inference that deviates. Rather, there has been no inference at all. This is erroneously considered an inference. He sounds angry. I love it. Likewise, testimony is defined as instruction by a trustworthy authority, where a trustworthy authority means, quote, someone who knows something directly, an instructor with a desire to communicate it faithfully as it is known. There is no false testimony on this view. If you are misinformed, you have not heard testimony, but pseudo-testimony. Following Dusty and Phillips, I'm going to call this the factive understanding of pramana, pramana being knowledge sources, instruments of knowledge. It's part of the law-like character of perception, conceived factively, that it can only teach the perceiver the truth, so also with the other ways of knowing. As Dusty and Phillips observe, the factive way of understanding perception, inference, and testimony stands in sharp contrast with the non-factive approach that is characteristic of most contemporary epistemology. Theorists such as reliabilists understand perception, inference, and testimony as cognitive processes that have, at best, a good chance of getting you onto the truth. So perception in this looser sense includes not only the success case of actually seeing water, but also, you know, the vertical hallucination, and often emphasize that those processes call on very similar types of activity in the visual cortex, or from the internalist perspective, that they produce very similar conscious phenomenology. For the reliabilist, the very same belief-forming mechanisms that produce knowledge when all goes well can also produce false judgments in adverse circumstances. That last idea is known as fallibilism. The fallibilist holds that an instance of knowledge can have a justifying basis or grounding that could in other circumstances support a false belief. It's not possible to have knowledge. They say it is possible to have knowledge on the basis of some process that produces a high but not perfect ratio of true to false judgments, as long as the judgment in question falls on the true side and some further conditions obtain. Now, it's sometimes suggested that we must accept this non-factive understanding of the cognitive processes that generate knowledge if we're to have any hope of accounting for the natural occurrence of knowledge in a species such as ours. I think this is a mistake, and I'm going to be arguing in this series of lectures that the old school factive understanding of perception, inference, and testimony is absolutely crucial in explaining both the natural occurrence of human knowledge and our capacity to detect it in ourselves and others. And this is actually mainly because both natural selection and reinforcement learning select for actual success as opposed to merely apparent success. I should be clear that from the start that to adopt my kind of infallibilism is not to say that humans are generally infallible in their judgments. Our judgments must be right when they're produced by perception in the proper sense of the word, but many of the judgments that we make that feel to us like they're based on perception actually have a weaker basis. They're not so well grounded. Now, I know this could all sound like really pointless verbal quibbling about where you draw the line around the word perception, and I really hope, for my sake as well as yours, that it feels less like that by the end of this year. Okay, in any event, having introduced the concept of a pramana, or knowledge source, the author of the sutras draws a distinction between knowledge sources and objects of knowledge, and this is often just cashed out as the difference between the causes of knowledge and the contents of knowledge. So first he points out that the very same source can be known, the very same object can be known through various different sources. For example, you might know that there's a fire in some distant location through testimony, or you might see the smoke and make an inference as to its presence, or you might get close to it and actually see the flames yourself through perception. Then he observes, and this is Sutra 2.116, knowledge sources may be objects of knowledge, like a measuring scale. His commentator Vatsyayana helpfully unpacks the analogy. A measuring scale is a source of knowledge when, for example, you weigh some lumps of gold against its reference weights. But it can also be an object of knowledge when you calibrate the scale, checking those reference weights against some independently known standard. Upon checking, you can confirm that the scale is weighing fairly. As evidence for the claim that knowledge sources can themselves be objects of knowledge, Vatsyayana observes that we say such things as, it is by perception that I know it, or my knowledge is inferential. Sources of knowledge are commonly, as he puts it, grasped in individual instances. Typically, you're not just left with this inexplicable conviction that there is a fire on the hill. Typically, you're aware that you heard about it from somebody or made an inference from the smoke or saw the flames. Beyond individual instances of operative knowledge sources, Vatsyayana observes that it's also the case that we understand them, that is, sources of knowledge, also through technical analyses in specific ways. And here he cites the definition of perceptual knowledge as arising from the connection of the sense faculty with an object. The text then addresses some concerns about the need for a knowledge source to be known or established, specifically whether or not a pramana would need to be established by another pramana. It might seem we face the threat of either an infinite regress, that's Sutra 2.117, or an arbitrary acceptance of something without reason, that's Sutra 2.118, which they immediately point out, you know, blows up the point of the whole project. To this pair of unattractive options taken together, Gautama responds magnificently. And this is the image that I promised you. No, pramanas are established like the light of a lamp. The lamp illuminates other objects, causing them to be perceived. But it itself can also be an object of perception. Vatsyayana says it itself would be known through another instance of perception. Now, it's notable that another instance of perception is called for. The claim is not that the self-same act of perception delivers both the knowledge of the clay pot that is illuminated by the lamp and also the shining of the lamp onto the clay pot at once. The content is different when you simply perceive that the pot is there and when you perceive that the lamp shows us that the pot is there. The distinction actually need not even be between two successive moments of perception. So Vatsyayana pushes this analogy further, and he points out, yeah, actually, you could know that, that the lamp illuminates the pot also by inference, because you can experiment with what happens when you take away the lamp and then restore it. You can also know the same thing through testimony. He says, trustworthy authorities will tell you, in the darkness, use a lamp. I'm telling you that now. That's a true thing. Okay, where am I now? All right. If you're using the lamp as a source of knowledge, lighting up other objects with it, there's no standing need to also look at the lamp itself, perform little experiments, or seek out testimony on it. Although you might in some cases do so. Sutra 2.120 says, I think rather intriguingly, there is no fixed rule here. Lastly, as a bonus touch, the common occurrence of successful discourse and action is held up as evidence that we are not, in fact, subject to an infinite regress of seeking iterations of knowledge. Remember that fact. We will need it later in the series. Okay, there are centuries of scholarship on what it means for sources of knowledge to be established like the light of a lamp. I will follow a single thread from this tapestry. Sure, the lamp illuminates, enabling other objects to be seen, but it itself is visible. Indeed, it can be seen very well. Shining lamps are eminently visible. Cashing out the metaphor, but Samuel suggests that instances of perception are themselves readily perceptible. He's got a big tent picture of perception here. So Vatsyayana mentions the first-person version of this point in his discussion of the various ways the fire could be known, right? He says, my knowledge is perceptual. You're aware of that when you see the flames. But we could also focus on the second and third-person variants. So from where I'm standing, I can see that you all see this lectern. I could feel, if I were to press a key into the palm of your hand, that you feel it too. We have remarkable shifts, we have remarkable sensitivity to shifts in the focus of someone's gaze, to what someone's attending to. So you can resolve the focus of gaze with uncanny accuracy. Spying on a third party, we can notice that we can see that he's noticed the drama unfolding in front of him and that he's unaware of what's happening behind his back. We can tell that other people hear the amplified speaker, but can't hear what we're whispering to each other behind cupped hands. Some instinctive capacity to map what is within the sensory scope of other animals is advantageous to every prey species and every predator. Live perceptual sensitivity to the perceptual ranges of others gives us a large set of easily spotted positive instances of knowledge. Indeed, because perceptual ranges fall into, I have to get behind the lectern for this next point. Because perceptual ranges fall into familiar, recognizable patterns, we can see not only when others share clear perceptual access to some object in common view. At a glance, we can see that we all see this lectern. But also when others have perceptual access to objects that we cannot immediately perceive ourselves. So I easily perceive you as seeing what's on the far side of this lectern, now obstructed from my direct view. Further expanding our reach, as the Nyaya observe, instances of perceptual knowledge are knowable not only by being themselves directly perceived, but also by being perceived by others. They're knowable through testimony. So suppose you're wondering whether a mutual friend knows about a fire I witnessed. I can tell you that, yes, she was there and saw it firsthand. In support of the notion that many instances of knowledge are easily recognized as such, we can look at the emergence of mental state concepts in typically developing children. This is territory I'll review more closely in the fourth lecture. But in broad outline, children show a sudden jump in their awareness of sight lines around 9 months of age, and they start to understand testimonial and inferential knowledge over the next year. A grasp of what other agents do and do not know opens the door to selective social learning. I'll just mention very briefly a characteristic experiment on this. This is from work by Lewis Moses and colleagues from 2001. So in the experiment, they put an ambiguous toy on the floor in front of children around 1 year of age. It's an octopus with like a jiggling motor inside it, and then you have a caregiver in the room who emotes either positively, wow, nice, or negatively, ew, yuck, as soon as the child fixates gaze on the toy. There are two conditions. In one, the experimenter has a clear view of the object, and in the other, her view is obstructed as she's saying, wow, nice, she can't even see the object. And infants already at 12 months of age and much more clearly by 18 months are much more likely to approach the toy if the confederate is positive about it emotionally. But this effect is completely canceled if she doesn't have a clear view of the object, right? So her emotional response is being understood in light of some mapping of what she can actually see. So that's selective social learning. Over time, our early sensitivity to the sensory fields of others seems to be generalized into a more abstract detection of epistemic territory or fields of expertise within which we trust others to be knowledgeable, such as the names of their pets, their recent experiences, their immediate plans. You know, you can just ask someone if they're coming to dinner tonight. You're coming, Fred? Yeah. And you take their word for it when they reply, either way. Sociologists of conversation contend that virtually all conversational turns are motivated and subsequently guided by territorial representations of disparities in knowledge. As children mature, their selective responsiveness to knowledge is scaffolded with the explicit use of the verb to know in conversation. So 2-year-old children are already using this verb frequently, affirming and denying their own knowledge, actually quite competently, querying the knowledge of their partners in conversation. So this is a lot of work with Paul Harris, and that's cross-culturally robust. English-speaking children are hearing the verb to know 17 times in an average conversation and using it themselves in one out of every 30 utterances they make. In adult English, the verb to know remains one of the most common verbs, and certainly in all the languages that I've been able to survey, there's some verb meaning know in the top 20 verbs by frequency. Linguistic evidence points to another cross-cultural commonality of note. The distinctions drawn by the Nyayakas between perception, inference, and testimony run deep. Incidentally, I'm pushing analogy under the rug for reasons I can talk about in question period. The same major lines are drawn between knowledge sources in multiple languages around the world. Roughly a quarter of the world's languages have obligatory grammatical marking of evidence source. These are evidentials. And those show up as verb endings in some languages, as particles in others, or affixes. And they designate the basis of the speaker's utterance. So in the Macaw language of the Pacific Northwest, for example, the sentence, "the weather is bad," would be uttered with a different verb ending depending on whether it was based on a glimpse of the darkening skies, a report heard on the radio, or the sight of people entering the lecture hall with dripping clothing and umbrellas. In some languages, such as Tibetan, there's a further ego evidential that's used if one's awareness of the bad weather is grounded on something with the privacy of an inner ache that portends a storm. But most languages with evidentials lump aches and pains in together with outward perception, as do the Nyaya. Peggy Spies has argued there are 4 major categories here. Inner sense, that's the ego evidential, hunger, pain, dizziness. Perception, inference, and testimony. She actually has different names for them, which I don't like, so I renamed them. And her claim is not that all languages with evidentials have distinct markings for these 4 categories. Rather, the lines between these categories are the major fault lines in sorting out sources of knowledge. So you've got some languages like Cherokee and Turkish that just have a split between ego and between the direct and indirect. And you have some languages such as Estonian, so the top 2 categories versus the bottom 2. Languages such as Estonian just have a marking to divide testimony from the rest. Some languages have subdivisions, for example, between more and less direct forms of inference. But only where they have the break line between inference and the rest. In all languages, evidentials form a small closed class, never more than 5 distinctions. And there's no language that has obligatory grammatical marking of, this is Peggy Spies, other culturally salient ways of learning, such as divine revelation or parental edict. Spies has argued that these categorizations are actually mapping something about the social situatedness of knowledge. So that ego evidential is marking something private within the speaker. The perceptual evidential is marking something out here, public, in the deictic sphere of the conversation, perhaps, or in the immediate awareness of the speaker. That testimonial evidential is marking something in the world outside the deictic sphere of a conversation, so they say, beyond speaker and addressee. Inferential evidential is actually a combination of material that is available publicly, those dripping clothes, the umbrellas, and something from within the speaker. I gather that the weather is bad, so it's a combination of those 2 things. Languages like English can mark source with optional lexical devices. So we can say, I hear that the weather's bad, I gather that it's bad, I feel in my bones that it's bad. In English, we have the option of just making the claim without marking our source, just as in many other languages, but not English, you have the option of uttering a finite clause with no tense marking. You can just say something along the lines of party at Rhonda's without indicating whether that is going to happen or happened last night. But even when our judgment is expressed without source marking, there's evidence we're still tracking source. That being conscious of the bad weather from seeing the sky is somehow different for us from being conscious of it on the basis of a radio report. And indeed, it's because this basic fourfold distinction is psychologically natural for us anyway that languages can call upon it in grammaticalization, just as it's because we're naturally tracking the temporal relationships of tense and aspect that languages can have that into their grammar. People in different times and cultures may differ widely in what they know, but at the structural level, we seem to recognize and overtly mark similar patterns of knowledge formation. A recent review of children's capacities for knowledge attribution concludes that, quote, this is my colleague Samuel Rumford, all children, irrespective of culture and language, eventually arrive at the same fundamental conception of knowledge in the preschool years. And this review doesn't actually spell out the content of this conception beyond situating it as whatever is commonly produced by perception, inference, and testimony. There's an obvious candidate for the commonality. These are all modes of access to reality, ways of producing the type of mental state whose contents must be true. This leads us to the promised abstract eight-word characterization of the nature of knowledge. This may sound familiar to you. Knowledge is the most general factive mental state. And that's Williamson, 2000, Knowledge and Its Limits. That simple characterization of knowledge has been systematically defended in the work of Timothy Williamson, who's adapting the terminology of affectivity from earlier work in linguistics. I kind of feel like I could skip this paragraph at Oxford, but it's being recorded, so I'm going to just plow through it. Fact propositional attitudes are necessarily restricted to taking true complements. So if S knows that P, or S realizes that P, or S is aware that P, then P must be the case. By contrast, non-factive propositional attitudes range over the larger field of all conceivable propositions, true and false. These attitudes include believing that P, suspecting that P, being certain that P. Ordinary semantic intuition can serve as a test for factivity. Sounds contradictory to say something like, Bill was aware that he was on the right train, but he was not. There's no felt contradiction in Bill felt sure that he was on the right train, but he wasn't. Being aware that is factive, feeling sure isn't. Williamson's distinctive claim is that knowing is the most general factive mental state, so that any factive mental state entails knowing. If one sees that P, then one knows that P, and so on. Knowing is the common denominator. All mental states that necessarily bind a subject to the truth are ways of knowing. I feel like I should add some words like undeviating in there. But okay, it's easy to see how perceiving, conceived in the Nyaya success way, is a factive state of mind. It calls for causal contact between the perceiver and the object, producing a judgment that is undeviating from what is true. A hallucinator might hit the truth by chance, as in Dharmuttara's 8th century example of the thirsty desert traveler who is led by a mirage of water to a valley, which coincidentally does happen to contain water hidden under a rock. But here the truth of the desert traveler's initial judgment is not essential to his way of judging. And Dharmuttara's intuitive verdict that this traveler does not know that there is water in the valley as he stands hallucinating on the hill, that judgment is well replicated both in epistemologists and in ordinary people. The idea that there could be subjectively justified true belief without knowledge was independently rediscovered by Edmund Gettier in 1963. And I'm going to follow contemporary Anglophone practice in calling these Gettier cases. And I'm doing this in part because it's contested exactly which Sanskrit philosopher was the first to discover this type of case. For details on that, I refer you to my colleague Janardhan Guneri's book, The Concealed Art of the Soul. It's a sign of the general natural ease of knowledge detection, that there's long-standing and broad cross-cultural agreement both on its presence in paradigmatic cases of perception, testimony, and inference, and on its absence in gayer cases. One small study in experimental philosophy a couple decades ago raised doubts about whether epistemic intuitions were cross-culturally robust. More extensive research in the years following has confirmed that the majority of people from cultures around the world do report the standard philosophical responses, judging that knowledge is present in paradigmatic instances of perception, inference, and testimony, and absent in gettier cases. Knowledge is a very strong condition. It's not enough that the subject makes a true judgment, or even that the subject does so for what seemed to him to be good reasons. The subject must be in a state of mind of a general type that one could only have to truths, an inerrant and undeviating type. And humans around the world seem to have a sharp eye for this. Okay, now I'm going to give you the case for the other side. If knowledge sources are established like the light of lamps, epistemology should be easy. But on second thought, sometimes sources of light are hard to look at directly. And after trying to look right at them, it can become harder to see the things that they were previously illuminating. Like bat's eyes dazzled by the light of day, says Aristotle. That's how reason is in our soul towards the things that are most manifest of all. The guy has a point. If the character of knowledge is simple, how strange that we have to sidle up to it through examples and metaphors and instances of particular semantic infelicities, as if we're trying to judge the shape of knowledge from the shadows that it casts. And there's bad news in those shadows. Contemporary philosophers commonly start from intuitive responses to cases and search for a characterization of knowledge that will fit them nicely. This actually seems to have been true of the Nyaikas as well. Rather than arguing from self-evident first principles about knowledge that the desert mirage of water shouldn't count as perception, Vatsyayana suggests, after his detailed description of the illusion, that the reverse path was taken. Remember, he says, quote, "So, to exclude such false cognition from the definition of perception proper, the author of the sutras includes the qualifier inerrant in that definition." Obviously, once you drive ahead and you discover that the desert road is in fact dry, you realize, I did not in fact perceive that there was water on this road. In truth, but perhaps less obviously, when you're giving an abstract general characterization of knowledge, you stuff in a word like inerrant, as if this abstract fact were not quite pre-theoretically self-evident. Reliance on intuitive judgment is what opens up our puzzle. If you live by the sword, get ready to die by it. Philosophical characterizations of knowledge are controversial. In particular, many philosophers rejected the theory that it is the most general fact of mental state. And I think I know why. Like, the controversy is readily fueled by a range of intuitions about particular cases, intuitions with no less force than the ones that we marshaled on the positive side. If I started by suggesting that paradigmatic cases of knowledge are out in the open and readily perceived, it's no less compelling to describe knowledge as an invisible state and a mysterious one. Even at this distance, I mean, we're, I guess, 5 meters apart, supposedly I can resolve the focus of your gaze within 30 seconds of arc, so I can tell whether you're looking at the bridge of my nose or the side of my face. But that's not strictly equivalent to detecting a state of perceptual knowledge in you. On second thought, your outward display of visual attention might mask some inner impairment, hesitation, or doubt, hallucination. Perhaps you're not straightforwardly judging this lectern to be here. Perhaps you're now in suspension. actively wondering whether it's an illusion or a dream. Oh, not that dream again, where the speaker goes on and on. We are, after all, at an epistemology lecture. We've all had that dream. Your face need not betray any readable signals of your inner qualms. Errors are possible in the other direction as well. Not that that makes anything any better, right? Like, I'm assuming that you can't see, you know, what I'm doing with my hand behind here, even if some hidden cameras or mirrors or whatever bring that within your range. Mind reading, that's the detection of perceptual states, states of knowledge, states of belief. That can be a tricky business. And you really want to crank up how tricky the business is. Think about cases in which others are engaging in mind reading of their own, reading it back or reading other people. So I suggested a few minutes ago on the other side of the ledger that we all knew at a glance that we can all see this lectern. And on second thought, that was an outrageously strong claim, partly because of the shape of this room. But anyway, surely a more responsible speaker would have worried about whether someone in the room might be failing to see it. And even if we are, let's stipulate for a moment that we are all in fact seeing this thing, there must by now be at least one anxious person who's concerned that someone here, even one person here, could be failing to see it. And if this worry wart refrains from judging that all of us can see the lectern, then I would be overstepping to declare that all of us clearly know that we all see it. That's not even true anymore, if it ever was. Who am I to say how everyone else in the room is reading everyone else's mental states, especially when those states concern everyone else's states of mind and so on? This kind of reflection seems to destroy the possibility of common knowledge, at least as classically conceived, where the classical conception of common knowledge is that a group of people commonly know that there's a lectern here if we all know that we all know that we all know it, so on ad infinitum. Harvey Lederman has recently published a disturbingly compelling argument to the effect that we cannot have any common knowledge as classically conceived of any substantive empirical fact, no matter how obvious it is. And I guess what's worrisome is that it's not obvious what we could put in place of that classical conception. We might start to worry now that our earlier sense of shared and open epistemic access to reality was something of an illusion. As evidence that sources of knowledge are grasped in particular instances, the Nyayikas were happy to observe that we can easily say, it is by perception that I know it, or my knowledge is inferential. But on second thought, one worries that such pronouncements can also readily accompany hallucination or fallacious reasoning. If someone I trust tells me there's a fire on the hill, I will just as confidently pronounce, it is by testimony that I know it, when I'm being misled as when I'm being instructed by a knowledgeable speaker. Sociologists of conversation aren't wrong that there are domains within which we habitually treat others as authoritative, but here too there could seem to be a problematic gap between habitual and accurate practice. When you tell me you'll be coming for dinner, Fred, I take your word for it, and I do so even when, unbeknownst to us, sorry about this, the bus that will knock you down on your way has already started on its ominous journey in our direction. If my common practice is to treat you as knowing about your upcoming activities and so forth, one might worry this is a lazy approximation on my part. On reflection, it's far from clear how I could ever be recognizing the zone within which you are in a state of mind of a type that can only be born to truths. There is no consolation to be had in the thought that this reflective mindset is the disease of the learned. It is not. It's very easy to produce the same kinds of reactions in lay people. For example, this is some empirical work I did, after reading a case involving a woman wondering what time it is and glancing at a clock. A large majority will describe her as coming to know what time it is. However, if we insert a reminder of the familiar fact that clocks are sometimes stopped or broken, even while stipulating that this particular clock is working, the majority swings the other way, and they refuse to count our clock glancer as knowing. Similar troubles arise for small remembered facts, such as the location of one's recently parked car. An explicit reminder of the standing risk of car theft is enough to quash, to chill the ordinary tendency to describe yourself as knowing where it currently is. The standing risk of a bus mishap or broken clock, that was always there. Even when we earlier took ourselves to know about simple plans and the time of day, now that we mention those background truths, our naively positive knowledge descriptions don't look so good. And those impressions are also cross-culturally robust, as you can see in that study by Waterman and colleagues. In an otherwise darkened room, if you stare for a while at the blazing lamp, the pot becomes harder to see. Some ways of scrutinizing our epistemic status seem to leave us trapped with an array of unpleasant options. Infallibilism now seems to lead to some form of skepticism, perhaps a phenomenalism of the present moment, perhaps contextualism, which I see as an especially pernicious form of skepticism. Fallibilism might now appear more promising. Perhaps knowledge doesn't require an inerrant justifying basis, but some conjunction of weaker conditions. Having abandoned the idea of a mental state of a type whose contents must be true, now seems strange to classify knowledge as a mental state at all. Within the mind of the subject, there is some condition produced by a natural but imperfect mechanism, some fairly reliable cognitive process. Perhaps knowledge is a condition that involves that inner component, that inner mental component, together with some further non-mental conditions, including, of course, the actual truth of the relevant proposition. Epistemologists will be familiar with the extreme difficulties we have had in coming up with any satisfactory formulation of such a conjunction. And it's also far from clear how we could intuitively calculate such complex conditions as have been proposed in real time. But what I want to highlight now is not the professional difficulties of professional epistemology, but the strange resilience of common practice. We do, as a matter of fact, keep attributing knowledge in ordinary conversation. Someone asks if I know whether you're going to be at dinner, and I say yes in a heartbeat on the strength of your having told me so. And I took you to know. But if the condition in which you will in fact be joining me at dinner is currently indistinguishable for me from the condition in which you said you'd join but you're about to be hit by a bus, then there's some audacity in me claiming to know right now that you'll be there. These worries are not hypothetical. We've all been burned at some point, claiming to know something that turned out false, claiming to spot knowledge in someone else where it was absent. And yet we keep jumping back in, saying we have knowledge of our own and attributing it to others. I can't begin to explain how I could be differentiating between good cases and superficially similar rivals, and yet it might seem I'd have to be able to do that in order to know whether knowledge is present in any instance. For virtually any empirical claim, there's a superficially similar rival that can be imagined. I think we've reached the point in this talk where people will start sort of surreptitiously, like taking a glance down at their wrist. I have to make someone actually do this. Thank you, Richard. I know I take Richard as maybe knowing what time it is, but am I just lucky in that attribution if his watch turns out to be one of the good ones? Not that I could tell at this distance. What is it for Richard to know the time, and why do I ordinarily speak and act as though I could spot that condition from across the room? Whatever knowledge might be, it's far from obvious how the contours of this state could be learned by the likes of us. It's also far from obvious what purpose our attributions are serving and why we keep making them when weaker and safer substitutes are readily available. For example, rather than claiming to know that you'll be at dinner, I could just claim that you believe that you'll be there. And that weaker claim has still perfectly good predictive value. And my entitlement to the stronger claim is mysterious, and the added value that it brings is questionable. Okay, now I've done both sides. So I think both the intuitively positive and reflectively negative ways of thinking about knowledge are natural to us, and I want to know why. I want to know why the availability and apparent legitimacy of the negative way of thinking doesn't stamp out the positive way, and why it doesn't convert us to just using weaker substitutes. I want to know whether there's any value in the adversarial interaction between these two ways of thinking about knowledge. So let's start by clarifying exactly where the switch occurs. Real-time conversational exchanges are generally handled in the positive, generous way. But the difference here is not a difference between live interaction and hypothetical musing. It's very easy to get people to generate positive knowledge attributions for hypothetical cases. And it's also quite possible to get people to feel negative about live interaction, if I got anybody to feel bad about this lectern a few minutes ago. The issue is not that one is becoming self-conscious about one's epistemic state. Ordinary judgments of the form, it is by inference that I know this, remain typically non-skeptical. The line of contrast is not a contrast between hasty and careful cognition. The members of the jury can conclude, after extremely careful and elaborate reasoning, that the defendant knew that the biscuits were poisoned as he served them to his guests. And on the other side, the participant in an X-Fi survey can very casually mark the clock glancer as not knowing after having been exposed to a line about the possibility of broken clocks. In one important sense of intuitive, both the positive and negative ways of thinking about knowledge are intuitive. We don't have much introspective access to their workings. The computations supporting knowledge attribution are more like those in face and voice recognition than those in long division. If you see the face of a good friend, you have an instant sense of who it is, even though you cannot articulate the characteristics in virtue of which you make that identification. And apologies to anyone with face blindness, as this example will not resonate with you, but you can use voice recognition instead, which is structurally exactly parallel. You hear a close colleague's voice in the hallway outside your door, and you know who it is, even though there is no, I hope that's working for you, there's no, you can't articulate the vocal qualities that distinguish him. So those intuitive or type one forms of cognition are involuntary, automatic, they don't tax working memory. We don't have much of a sense of the computations underlying these. Other automatic and effortless type 1 processes include single-digit arithmetic, reading simple words in a language you know well. You can contrast those with type 2 or controlled types of cognition, syllogistic reasoning, long division, where you've got to lay conscious attention on a controlled series of steps, and that tends to leave an outline of how the result was achieved. There is, however, one consciously available element, a little bit of an outline here, that figures crucially in the negative cases. In each case, I tried to get you to imagine something that I stipulated as a potential rather than actual part of the scenario, the phantom bus, the worry ward, the broken clock. If it were actual, we agreed this wouldn't be a case of knowledge. The question is, why are instinctive epistemic evaluation downgraded on merely imagining the thing? And perhaps also why our initial instinctive evaluation was positive despite our general recognition that this sort of problem could always be waiting in the wings, and our memories of actually having been burned by such reversals. So I think progress can be made here if we start by approaching the problem from the side, looking at a simpler area of cognition with some helpful parallels to epistemic navigation. Let's talk about spatial navigation. So we often travel well-known routes on mental autopilot with familiar landmarks serving as cues to turn or continue, producing a sequence of habitual responses that will get you home with little attention to possible choices. That's called model-free cognition. We're also capable of thinking strategically, consulting a mental map to plan a journey. Say, when confronted with the addition of some side errand that you need to perform along the familiar route, that's model-based cognition. Model-free cognition, less costly in the moment, requiring no attention, but it's inflexible. Model-based cognition, more sophisticated, but also more taxing. Many animals, including rats, we'll talk about this next time, have both modes of spatial navigation. They switch between them as required. And perhaps humans are going to have both model-free and model-based cognition in epistemic evaluation. We've got a level of habitual representation, and then we've got a more strategic level that we draw out for special circumstances. Okay, back on the side of spatial navigation. Many of you here will have some kind of mental map of the town that we're in right now. If not, play this game, imagining a more familiar locale. If you know Oxford, I want you to imagine that all exits from this building have been sealed except for the one leading out onto Banbury Road. And further imagine that Banbury Road itself is completely barricaded to all traffic, including foot traffic, just up the road in whichever direction would be more inconvenient for you as you are leaving this lecture and heading for dinner or home. Now, on hearing this scenario, I expect that most of you will be able to plot a route that overcomes this hypothetical obstacle. And I expect that this is the route that you wouldn't otherwise have taken. But here's something that probably didn't happen in the course of that imaginative exercise. You probably did not change your mental map of Oxford in any way. You kept my hypothetical scenario nicely quarantined as hypothetical. You don't now feel inclined to like turn in a different direction as you leave, setting aside the exceptional circumstance of actually seeing a barricade there. I suddenly think I should have conspired to set that up. That would be so weird. Okay. I expect you don't feel inclined to say anything different about where things are located in this town. Reasoning about the hypothetical barricade scenario just exploited your navigational capacities. It didn't rewire them in any way. In spatial navigation, there's a sharp distinction between seeing a road closure and just imagining one. In epistemic navigation, somehow the line between discovering and imagining is a lot more weird. If we have some kind of map of what is known by whom, a map which initially puts Fred's dinner plans squarely within his epistemic territory. Where's Fred going to go for dinner? Ask Fred, he knows. We seem to reach in and redraw that map a bit when we start imagining the hypothetical bus incident. Just on the strength of that imagined scenario, it now seems he doesn't quite know that he'll be at dinner. Our behavior changes, too. We can find ourselves unwilling to say the things we were saying a moment before, even if only temporarily. One of my goals for the lectures ahead is to explain how our ordinary epistemic mapping works and what function is served by this odd plasticity in the face of what's merely imagined, as opposed to what's actually being witnessed. To explain the rudiments of epistemic mapping, we need to investigate the experiences that make it possible. One important category of experiences here is metacognitive. So this category includes, for example, the feeling of familiarity produced by fluency and ease of processing. In general, metacognitive experiences are consciously available summaries of how our cognitive process is going. The feeling of familiarity is the feeling of home. It's what I was trying to evoke at the outside when I referenced the face or voice of a close friend. There's also a feeling which is the opposite of this, a feeling whose most extreme form occasions a gasp, a cry of, oh my God, a bit of sweat on the back of your neck and a sense that I did not see that coming at all. And one might imagine that the pursuit of knowledge is driven by some kind of aversion to that stone-cold plot twist feeling and some kind of love for the cozy and the familiar. It would be very strange if it were the reverse, if somehow the pursuit of knowledge were, at a very deep level, driven by the love of surprise. So if you love surprises, come back on Wednesday.